Welcome to Hebrew Bible Insights, a podcast about making sense of the Hebrew Bible. I'm Matthew Delaney. Ever since I read an article called The Rational Poet, Appealing to the Heart and the Mind in the Book of Judges by Dr. Michelle Knight, I knew I have to get her on our podcast. She has some really great content on poetry and the book of Judges. There's so much poetry in the Hebrew Bible, and if we don't understand how biblical Hebrew poetry works, then frankly, we are going to completely miss what's going on with the Hebrew Bible. But one of the parts that gets overlooked quite often is the poetry that's embedded within narrative. For example, the Song of Deborah within the book of Judges. And this type of poetry plays a really unique role. And Dr. Michelle Knight, she elucidates on this in a really erudite way. She is brilliant, great communicator. We're glad to have her on. The Book of Judges is also one of my favorite books. I know it's kind of a dark book, but I think there is so much wisdom for us to learn from this story. And I think it plays a really pivotal role in the history that the prophets of the Hebrew Bible tell. And it's just absolutely pivotal. So we focus especially on the story of Deborah, which there's so much interesting to go on with her, yet somehow she is really overlooked and she doesn't get as much attention as she deserves. And so we talk a lot about Deborah. What is this story? She shares really interesting insights in the depth of this story, as well as she talks about the relation between Deborah and the rest of the book of Judges, comparing to other judges in the book. And there's so much we get into, including listener questions. We have a wonderful conversation with her, and we have some resources if you want to connect more with her that we have linked in the show notes. So thank you all for listening to today's episode. Without further ado, let's go ahead and dive in. Deborah, the Book of Judges, poetry and narrative, former prophets. We got a lot of great content for you in this episode, and you guys are lucky because today we have a wonderful special guest, Dr. Michelle Knight. Thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, thank you.
So, before we dive into your content, in case someone's not familiar with you, could you just introduce us a little bit to you and also how you got into biblical studies and what your particular passion is within this area?
Totally. As you said, I'm Dr. Michelle Knight. I work at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School in the Old Testament and Semitic Languages Department. We are really focused on reading the text, reading it well, and making sure we understand its world, what it's doing literarily, the message it teaches us, and ultimately the way it speaks to us as contemporary Christians, and the way it should form us to think about God in this world. And so that has always been my passion. As I went to school actually thinking I was going to be in youth ministry. Like so many people about my age, it was a youth minister that really was really formative in my early years. So I thought I wanted to grow up and be just like him. And then I learned I actually didn't like youth all that much. They were great and all, but what I really enjoyed was teaching my peers. So I started studying intently. So I had a degree in biblical exposition from like a Bible college. But while I was there, I worked to help lead a small group with some other men, and they were preaching really regularly and started asking me questions about different texts. And what we discerned in that process was I was really good at helping people read to preach, helping mm-hmm. them read a text and understand what the author is trying to communicate. So then we can figure out how to communicate that same reality in our own setting. And so I was like, man, I need to figure out how to help teachers read Hebrew. And somebody was like, that's what seminaries do. And as I learned more about it, I found out certain seminaries do that. And that's where I really kind of focused my energy. And so especially because the Old Testament in my tradition was a little underappreciated, I think I gravitated toward that. I loved Hebrew. And so I said, okay, I'm going to teach in a seminary. So everything I did from that point was oriented toward that. And so even now, my passion in the classroom is helping people read the text well, making sure they understand the argument that's being made there, and they can be carried along with that argument, even as they have their own questions, even as they try to see the whole world, that they're following the thought flow of the person that put this book together. And then they are trying to figure out how that contributes to God's full message. And so I get to do that in a lot of my classes, and it's really a joy.
Sign me up. Where's this at? I want to be on the tour.
Yeah, that's what we do.
Well, on that note, how about we jump right into this wonderful story of Judges 4 and 5? And I suppose before we get into the very specific questions, maybe you could give us a brief overview of the story of Deborah so that our listeners are all on the same page.
Great. Well, the story of Deborah begins in Judges 4. We are in a place where yet again, the Israelites, the Hebrews, have come into a place of apostasy. They have turned their back on God. They started worshiping other deities. And so he strengthens an enemy against them the way he so often does. He sells them into the hands of Jabin, king of Canaan, which is interesting. And we can talk about Jabin later if we want to. But Jabin, actually, his forces are run by Sisera, who ends up being the more prominent enemy in the account. Sisera has 900 iron chariots or chariots with iron axles or something like that. And these chariots are kind of a big deal thematically, both in Joshua and Judges, is kind of the prototypical armament of the unbeatable Canaanites on the plains. And so we already, the story is set up to be one with a really vastly militarily superior enemy. What the story entails is people coming to Deborah, looking for help. She actually instigates the calling of the judge. Rather than us just hearing and then God rose up a judge, we hear Deborah actually be the vehicle through which that happens. Deborah's introduced as a prophet and a judge. Again, I imagine we'll get into that at some point in this interview. But she asks, Barak to come to battle, and ask is a soft word for what she does. She calls him to muster his troops. And so then we see this clash near the Kishon in the Jezreel Valley. We see him come to war. Sisera brings his war chariots. He brings foot soldiers. And yet, miraculously, the Israelites are, they win. But then we see Sisera get away. He runs into the tent of someone he expects to be an ally, Jael. But instead, she actually murders him there. And whether murder is the right word or not, I suppose, is something we could talk about too. But she drives a tent peg through his temple. And then Barak runs along and he witnesses this, and then the account ends. And it's, and that's how God beat the Canaanites in this situation. But then in Judges 5, we have Deborah with Barak sing on that day this song. And so then there's like 30 verses of a song where Deborah recounts all of those things again. She adds some new information. We hear from some other singers in there, and they kind of talk back through the battle. And then at the end of that, we get, and then Israel had rest, which is kind of the standard sign that this judge cycle is over and we're about to hear a new story.
Excellent. Very good. Yes, it's a lovely story for early in the morning, isn't it? Yes,
it's a joy. And,
yeah, I love it. So you've done a lot of research on this story. Maybe you could give us one real nugget, I suppose, from all of your research that you think, you know, this is something I'd like everyone to know about. In my intense study of this particular text.
Yeah. Well, text, I mean, one of the things I always say is we skip the poems when we read Tolkien, and we skip the poems when we read Judges or any other Old Testament book. Something about Judges 5 being stuck there is something that we as Bible readers have not really appreciated fully. The fact we forget when we read narratives, I mean, somebody can't photobomb a biblical narrative. When we take a picture in the park, somebody being in the background is outside of our control. But when someone paints an oil painting or when someone writes a narrative, every detail is inside of their control. Why exactly something is included is something that we as interpreters do our best to discern. We'll never know for sure. But a lot of times we have textual signals that help us discern that. And when we pay attention to those things, we have a lot more clarity. And so the fact that we have this song in there that's not just by anybody, it's by a prophet, is something that I think that we all haven't appreciated fully. And so a lot of my research has been, okay, so if we take this not just as a victory song, but as a prophetic word in the middle of a period where people were eager to hear from God or thought they weren't hearing from God, we can kind of fill that out. then the nuance of that song and the function it plays in the overarching story of Judges becomes a little clearer. And I think it helps us read Judges better.
I wonder if we can just dig deeper into that, because I think that is what that's some of the first stuff I learned from your content. It just kind of blew my mind, realizing, whoa, like this is a different way to view this song. Now, I know in general, we think about the former prophets and we forget that these historical books are written by prophets as well from a prophetic perspective. But now you have within Judges, chaotic story, someone who's not just a judge, also a prophet. And this has got to add some extra weight and importance to the things that she does and that she says. So I wonder if you could situate her song. What is she saying? What's the unique theological point that she's making, and how does that fit within the story of Judges?
Totally. Well, within the song, she does quite a few things. I mean, I mentioned earlier that it kind of walks back through the battle, but it doesn't just recount the historical events. A lot of people look at the two and they're trying to figure out why they sound so different. And sometimes I want to be like, we are asking all the wrong questions. Mm. What she is doing is retelling the story, but she's telling it from the perspective of someone who knows what God is doing. She is a prophet. She's God's mouthpiece. And so she's theologically interpreting what otherwise can't be totally understood on the ground to give us these interpretive statements like, and then they did evil, and then God did this. These people don't have that. They're on the ground without a narrator. And yet into this moment, Deborah steps in and narrates the battle for them with that same theological access that you and I get from these really heavily shaped narrated stories in the Old Testament or in the Hebrew Bible. And so she adds some new information. She kind of situates the whole battle and reminds everybody about the God who stands behind that battle. And so it opens with a portrait of Yahweh, the warrior. And so we have a theophany, much like the theophany we get at Sinai and these other places where God appears, but he's striding forth, he's marching forth as if he's going to battle. The verb there is yatsa. It's what people do when they go out to battle. And it's also at the end of the song, what she calls the army to do. Since he has gone forth, so too must you go forth. She is trying to help the people understand who God is and what he did here, so as to encourage them to do something different in the future. That's the prophetic quality of the song. And so because of that, we get some evaluations in the middle. She doesn't just talk about what happened in the battle. She evaluates the way different participants interacted. And so she talks about each of the tribes and the way they responded. She even talks about Barak briefly. He doesn't actually get censured, which is super interesting because we all want to attack Barak in the story. And in a full 30 verses where she walks through everybody and whether they did good or bad, she doesn't give Barak a hard time, which we should probably pay attention to. But she talks about each of the tribes, how they responded. She talks about Jael, kind of the surprising participant in the battle. She even talks about Meroz, which for all we can tell is a settlement within the area, and evaluates how they didn't come to the help of Yahweh and kind of uses that as a foil for what Jael does. And then she not only evaluates them kind of forthrightly, she sets up Jael in that text as a very vulnerable character and highlights her vulnerability in a lot of ways. She also does that with Israel in a way that the narrator of the book of Judges doesn't do as clearly. I mean, we hear in Judges 4 that Israel is in almost a dilapidated, we hear that they've been severely oppressed. And so we know that things are really hard for them. But there's a whole stanza included in the song that just reflects on the economic, socio-political kind of effect of this on Israel, how everybody was scared to go out on the roads. It's very similar to what we hear of Gideon in the next cycle, where he's hiding as he does his wine press kind of activities. And so we have her also theologically helping us see if God can use Jael to do this mighty thing when she was so vulnerable, can't too Israel in their vulnerability respond similarly? And so she sets up this kind of prophetic challenge. And in many ways, the rest of the book helps us discern to what degree they heard and accepted that challenge.
One niche question I want to ask you that I'm very interested in is, when a lot of people think about biblical Hebrew, we think about it as like a monolithic thing. Okay, there's the Hebrew in the Bible, but there are some differences between certain types of the Hebrew there. And famously, we have some archaic biblical Hebrew, with some of those little bit of noticeable differences, like with Jacob or Moses, a couple of their, the poetry associated to them. And then you also have Deborah and a few other parts. So she's kind of in this rare air of like a small collection of some of the most ancient things. And for some reason, again, trying to figure out why this would be, right? Like it's the, you know, it's, I almost wonder if it's almost like the How Great Thou Art song, where it's like, we don't speak that way anymore, but where it's made such an impact, you know, that we're not changing the way we sing this. Anyway, why do you think Deborah's song is one of the few portions of the Hebrew Bible that's in this archaic biblical Hebrew? And does that give any sort of clue as to other parts of the impact of the song?
I mean, at minimum, assuming it is written old and it's early, which is only, I mean, we can call something an archaic and suggest that it's written quite late. But I think the a consensus, I think there still exists a consensus that it is an old composition. Assuming that it is old, and that archaic Hebrew is showing that this is actually kind of what the song looked like back when it first started being sung, that would suggest it was kind of a part of cultural memory, and that it was actually passed down. I mean, we see Moses asking the people to do that with his song in Deuteronomy 32. That the people would learn this and that we'd teach it so that we'd continue to be actually a witness against them. It's not a positive situation. But assuming that that really was a pattern for kind of these prophetic songs, then we can assume something similar is done here. And I would suggest that's part of why Judges actually share so much themes with the song. Because so many people have said, if it's an old song, how does it fit so well in Judges? And I've always said, well, because they grew up hearing the song, it shaped the way they think about that, they thought about the Judges period. And I mean, we see that Psalm 68 quotes the song with some different images, which would suggest it's not just textual borrowing, but even the images kind of were evoked in memory. And so we hear it kind of reflected on slightly different ways. It's one of the songs people grew up singing. And so to preserve it probably was just fitting. And I imagine also it would give the readers an air of authenticity to remind them that the song was ancient and to preserve that ancient language when it was actually included in the book by whatever editor or author. It reminds them that this is something they've heard before and helps them see how it fit into everything else that transpired. That's how I would explain it. But of course, there's a lot of hypotheses in there.
Sure.
Do you consider, I mean, obviously, it's interesting that poetry is being used for this particular reason. We see, like you said, the Song of Moses. We have Exodus 15, for example, recounting the great moment of the Exodus. And then we have, even here, Judges 5. But we don't have maybe poetry in other stories in Judges where, you know, most people will gravitate towards maybe a Samson or something along these lines. So what is it about this moment that is so significant that it deserves, I suppose, a song on this level to remain in the cultural memory of ancient Israel and in perpetuity for anyone who comes in that lineage afterwards?
Yeah, I would argue that something about the Kishon battle is kind of paradigmatic for the people for a couple of reasons. One of them being that they were fighting against the Canaanites here. What's interesting about the book of Judges is it's set in a period where these people are left in the land, left in the land after Joshua. But the interesting thing is in our English Bibles, it says left all through Judges 2. And then it says God will leave all of these other nations. Well, the word there is actually not azav, to leave or abandon. It's nuach, he will cause to rest. And so what's actually interesting is most of the oppressors in the book of Judges aren't Canaanites. They're from outside the land. It's like instead of Israel being made to rest in the land, which was the promise all through Deuteronomy, it was Nuach. Instead of them being made to rest in the land, God brought in outsiders and made them rest in the land. So there were all these like foreign occupations. So beyond just the difficulty of the Canaanites being there, there were all these other folks that Israel had to deal with them too. But in Judges 4, we actually deal with the Canaanites, which is the whole reason that we're having issues at the Judges period. So it brings up this kind of, it's got a paradigmatic quality. And the fact that they're opposing Jabin, somebody by that same name shows up in Joshua. And so that kind of almost gives it a mythic quality. Like we've dealt with Jabin before and we remember what happened. And so that is important for us to hear also. Beyond that, we also have this moment where both the prophet and the judge are on the same page. As much as initially we see hesitancy, if not outright disobedience, from Barak, eventually he watches what happens, and we see him, I mean, he observes that Sisera fell in Jael's tent, and whether that's a judgment on him or not is something interpreters disagree about, but he observed that, and then he joined the prophet in helping everybody else observe that so that they could recognize what he had recognized. That's how I would read that. And so given that paradigmatic quality, she's able to step back and say, let's reflect on this battle and what God can do against Canaan, against those iron chariots that gave even Judah trouble in the conquest. Mm. Moreover, the fact that it was at the Kishon, and at least according to Judges 5, there's some miraculous stuff happening with water, makes it Exodus-like in certain ways.
Yeah, and so, interesting, yeah.
In Judges 6, where we have Gideon being like, you haven't done anything since the Exodus, God's like, okay, fine. Let me show this generation something Exodus-like. I'm going to deal with chariots. I'm going to deal with water. And I'm going to stride forth from Sinai. So we have all of this Exodus language too. So I think for a whole bunch of reasons, this battle ends up proving something about God uniquely, and allows both Deborah in writing the song, the editor in putting the book together, to really focus on what this shows us about the God who's acting the same way he did for their ancestors in this new space. The difference is the way the people are responding to him.
Yeah,
I wonder.
Fascinating.
You've already kind of touched on this a couple of times. I wonder if you can just maybe go a little bit deeper with this contrast between you go straight from the Song of Deborah to Gideon, and you point out I feel like we love us some Gideon, right? We feel like, wow, look at this person who's not confident, and you know, and God used him in a mighty way. And there's a whole can of worms we can get into with Gideon, but the contrast you make between Deborah, the Song of Deborah, and this story with Gideon, can you go there? Like what do you
say? Totally. When I wrote a term paper for a class, it was actually a wisdom theology class, and I was stretching the assignment to try to get it as close as possible to my dissertation. So I was writing about Jotham's fable, and I tripped across this in that paper, and I made the paper about that. And to this day, that professor's like, I mean, it was a good paper, but it was not the paper as you're right. But I remember sitting in my apartment at like 2 a.m. and being like, what are we doing? How did we miss this? In Judges 5, so we have a prophet lay out the longest speech by a deity, by a prophet, by anybody in the book of Judges, just lay out theology, line for line. Mm. It is just, this is the way God acts, and this is how you ought to respond to him. And so we have that for 30 verses. And then we have almost a new start with Judges 6. Judges 6 is unique kind of formally in a variety of ways. I mean, we're almost asked by the author to compare the two accounts because we have an Ish Naviah, Deborah the prophetess, Ish Naviah, and then an Ish Navi who shows up, a male prophet who shows up in chapter 6, which is kind of a weird anomalous title, which helps us compare the two accounts. We also have most of the time in the book, it says, and then the Israelites again did the evil, or again, they did evil in Yahweh's eyes. We don't have again in Judges 6. It's almost like a new start. It's really interesting. I don't want to make too big of a deal about it, but Lost in Stone actually has convinced me that we should kind of really pay attention to that. Hmm. It almost seems like something ends with Judges 5, and in Judges 6, now we're evaluating how's everybody going to respond to what we just saw. So we have a couple cues that something new is starting. And so here we have a new enemy. It's super mighty. And it's actually geographically proximate too. So one of the ways I've described it in the past is the Song of Deborah is literally like ringing in the ears of the people in the Kishon Valley. Like in this area, I mean, the song literally is just right there. And then we meet Gideon. We actually meet a prophet again first who says, you didn't remain faithful to covenant like I asked, despite the fact that I've saved you from all of these people. What's interesting is the prophet says, God saved you from the Egyptians and all of these other peoples. It uses the exact same verbiage we get all the way through the Pentateuch when it says the God who saved you from the Egyptians, but it adds on and all these other peoples to remind them that they've just heard, or to remind us as readers, that they've just heard that God's still doing Exodus-like stuff. So the prophet has just said that again. So there's been two divine speeches by prophets, each of them reminding that God has saved mightily. And right after that is where Gideon says, we know that you saved our fathers in the Exodus, but we haven't seen you save anybody since then. And wow. So what he says is word for word, the opposite of what that prophet has just said, and Deborah has laboriously explained in the previous chapter. And so Gideon comes to represent, what does it look like for someone to actually hear from God so emphatically, not just from two prophets, but then he gets the angel of Yahweh / Yahweh interacting with him so much through that chapter. And so that convinces us that readers, this isn't a revelation problem. This is a reception problem. And Gideon shows us what that looks like. So the entire Gideon story shows us someone who's actually really relatable. He's the only judge who worships. So we have all of these moments. So he, Hishta Hava, like he worships, bows down to Yahweh in a way nobody else does. We have him doing all of these good things, hearing from God, and yet also introducing idol worship to the extent where at the end of the Gideon cycle, all of this idol worship becomes a snare, which was the warning that God gave through Joshua. At the end of Joshua, he gave through the angel in Judges 2 that they would be a snare, and it comes to fulfillment with Gideon. And so it shows us, again, this isn't a revelation problem, it's a reception problem. And the rest of the book shows us what it looks like when people aren't willing to acknowledge that Yahweh is the only one who saves. Wow. So the depth of Gideon's personification, like he's the first judge we actually get to hear about their inner thoughts and their motivations. So it makes it more about evaluating the response. Whereas the earlier judges, we actually don't hear very much about their thought processes. We just hear about how God used them to do mighty things. But now we hear, how is this leader who represents the people actually responding? It's so fascinating. Wow.
That's you got so a line there of such good theology. What is this? That God is still doing Exodus-like things, you know, or Exodus-like stuff in our midst. I think that's fascinating, and it works all throughout Israel's history, doesn't it? There's always this moment of an Exodus-like thing happening. So,
And I wonder it's not about the revelation, but the reception.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's really that's too. Fascinating. So, maybe unpack for us what is a judge in ancient Israel or in this time, and what is a prophet? I guess what are the differences here?
Yeah, well, exactly how we want to define the judges in the book of Judges is something I don't know. I feel like the scholarship on this has been really fascinating because we have gone to great lengths to be like, okay, these are judges, but not like what you think. And then we talk about how judge means tribal leader. Mm-hmm. What's interesting to me is that this book is emphatically situated in Deuteronomy. Everything about it is like Deuteronomic to the core. And I'm like, dude, let's just assume judges are what Deuteronomy says judges are. We have judges in Deuteronomy, and it talks about what kings are. It talks about what judges are. It talks about what prophets are. And in fact, Judges 4 echoes Deuteronomy 19, which really reflects on what a prophet is at multiple points. So I'm just like, let's assume that that's what a judge is too. Judges there, they are leaders. We see judges actually do a variety of things if we trace where it shows up in different places, but they are someone to whom the people come for a decision. When the people don't know what to do, a judge is there to give them a decision. And so very frequently, that is what you and I would call judicial or legislative, where, you know, the conflict between people. And so it can have that kind of legislative connotation. And a lot of times that's what people assume Deborah's doing because she's sitting under the palm tree. Mm. What's interesting is that Moses sits under a tree just like that. And in fact, the text where he does that in Exodus is the text where they talk about how, wow, we really need other judges to help you with this. And I'm like, yeah, that's what Judges 4 is showing us she's doing. Yeah. She's doing Moses-like things. Wow. It's setting us up to hear, hey, she's the first prophet since Moses. Maybe we should pay attention to that.
Wow.
But judges help people make decisions. And so it seems like during, and they bring, judges are supposed to bring shalom. Judges are supposed to, they shafat, the word to judge is also something kings do. They're supposed to enact righteousness to the degree that they are capable. And so in the judges period, that extended to military affairs. These are the people that decided how they moved. And it took on, because of the time period, it took on a kind of military function. I mean, all of the offices of Israel took on a military function during this time period. I mean, priests were leading people. I mean, in the wilderness, they were marching with everybody else. And so I just think Deuteronomy should dictate for us what a judge is. I'll say that.
Yeah. How revolutionary of you. That's great.
I just feel like we've overcomplicated it so significantly. Yeah. But I do think what scholarship has done well is reminded us that that has a really broad range of activities involved in it. And they really are tribal chieftains is probably an accurate way of describing how they functioned. Yeah. It's just not so different from what we see in Deuteronomy. In as far as prophets, especially the way that Deuteronomy frames prophets is they are people who speak for Yahweh. Fundamentally, they have an authoritative voice. Deuteronomy, I said 19 earlier, I meant 18. Deuteronomy says that if somebody hears the word of a prophet and they know that that prophet's from Yahweh, God will hold them accountable to following through on what that prophet has said. And so the association of prophetic voice with Yahweh's authority is exceptionally strong. Mm. And the prophets were also the ordained is maybe not quite the right word, but the authorized spokesperson. So Deuteronomy goes through and kind of lists all of the different ways someone might try to hear from the divine and identifies some of them as inappropriate and some of them as appropriate. And the prophet is kind of the par excellence way of hearing from the deity. There are other ways, but that's the primary way. And so what's also set up is an authorized way of hearing from the deity in a world that will tell you to hear from the deity in a gajillion other ways. And that's especially the way Deuteronomy sets it up, because Deuteronomy is all about contrast between their ways and our ways. Mm. And so, I mean, the prophets kind of have a more tidy function within the biblical story. I mean, they show up, they speak, though there is quite a bit of difference between what we see like Elijah and Elisha doing over against what we see the writing prophets doing. And so it too depends on kind of the era and the needs, how a prophet's going to function and what other offices are in play. When there is a king, a prophet's doing something slightly different than when there isn't a king. And so at least during that time period, this time period, they seem to be someone who speaks for Yahweh. So we can see how that job overlaps with a judge a little bit, which is why Samuel also was a judge and a prophet, because there's somebody who lets people know what they need to do next.
And yet Samuel's sort of, and Samuel sort of feels like a judge at times, right? I mean, you get that with him as a prophet. It's like, are we in between? And then, okay, now we're going to move toward the king.
Exactly.
And the prophet's going to.
Exactly. And when his role becomes kind of that kingly advisor, that kingmaker, that's especially when we see something that we see with a lot of the prophets going forward, is that they become this kind of kingmaker role.
That's good.
I wonder, like, this might be too modern and too simple, but like, I think about you, like, again, I assume still serve as a deacon at your church and you're a professor. And, you know, this idea that you can only have one role, right? Like, I think we understand that we as people, we can have multiplicity of roles. Yeah. And we also understand that the way we view what a teacher is and only does today might not be what teachers did 2000 years ago.
Yes. And, absolutely.
You know, you think about, again, this is late, we're talking rabbinic period, but I love reading Pirkei Avot and in the Mishnah. And it's interesting to see what type of things the rabbis were viewed as being responsible for, right? Some things we would consider pastorally, some things we consider teacher, some things judge, and that's an all-encompassing multiplicity of things. So anyway, I think it's helpful how you break down, and we appreciate your, let's return to the simple, straightforward, what is a judge? That's really helpful. A question I had, you know, you're talking about this idea of the prophet, authoritative voice from God, right? This is like one of the best ways to know, learn about who God is. I can't help but think about an ironic later story with Jephthah, this judge who, again, how do we make sense of this guy who decides to sacrifice one of his own kids? Like, is the point that he just so doesn't know God that he can't differentiate him, who Yahweh is in contrast to the Canaanite deities? Like what's going on with this guy?
Yeah, Jephthah is such an enigmatic figure. What is, of course, interesting is he's the first judge who's raised up by the people rather than by God. After God says in chapter 10, listen, I'm not going to save you anymore. because at least on my reading, where it then says the next line, some people think he took compassion on him and he kept saving him. I don't think that's how we should read the Hebrew there. I'm pretty sure what it says is because they had really tried his patience and he was done. And so he preserves them. And so people like Samson begin to save. Jephthah begins to fight. And God makes sure that Israel is preserved. And so he saves them. But the decisive victory and the rest, they don't have for the rest of the book. And we see, obviously, both the Philistines and Ammon to a lesser degree. So especially the Philistines retain a foothold into the time of David. And so Samson didn't save Israel, even though he was a judge. And so God says, I'm not going to save them anymore, and I'm not going to raise up judges. And so he doesn't. And so the people raise up Jephthah, actually in almost the same way that they raise up Abimelech, which is noteworthy. But Jephthah ends up being a leader who scrambles. He is smart, but not quite smart enough, because he doesn't have, I would argue, divine. He's not hearing from the divine. He doesn't have divine guidance. And that's kind of conspicuous in his story, because Gideon has a ton of divine guidance, and so does Samson. So on either side of him, both guys have a ton of divine activity. So I feel like, with that being the case, and then also Jephthah talking the most about Yahweh of all of the judges, I mean, he gives a whole full speech. That seems to me to be a contrast about, like, the two people that had the most from God and ignoring it, and this person who had not much from God and felt like he could very comfortably talk authoritatively about spiritual matters. And we see the fallout. We see end up on the political stage.
Fascinating.
Pretending like somebody else's deity exists. We see him opening his mouth and causing all kinds of harm because he felt compelled to speak without the deity's permission, empowerment, or anything else. Does the spirit come on him? Absolutely. God uses this broken leader. But I think we see the fallout of him being ill-prepared for the task, which is why God did not raise him up.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know we didn't even prep you for that question. I realize that's a tough one. That was fantastic.
Fantastic answer. Yeah.
I mean, Jephthah, man, he's something. Yeah.
So I want to ask this question, which we did put in, because we're talking about biblical poetry. Why poetry? Why song? I mean, maybe there's a simple answer to this, but what are some misconceptions maybe about biblical poetry, emotion, and reason? But obviously, when you have something like Exodus 15, Judges 5, the writer, the author, they want you to remember this, right? They want this to be in you. And I think about how song is so impactful, even for my children, my boys, as they're growing. I could tell that song is important for them in gaining something you might not get just from narrative.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, it seems like the genre is ideal for people to remember. It also just seems to be the way that people, I mean, the poetry we see there is almost identical to the kind of poetry we see at Ugarit and other places where people are talking about their deities. So sometimes I wonder if that's just the standard theological genre, aside from legal texts and things like that. That's a stretch. So don't do much with that. The poetry, it just seems to be the way that biblical authors turn to this genre when they want to talk theology. It just seems to be the mode by which they do that. So we see that in the Psalter. I mean, when you look at a systematic theology textbook and you want to see all of the places they're turning to get all of that good God-centered content. It's a psalm. Because yeah. that's where people are just talking about what God is like. Mm-hmm. And so the songs seem to be ideal. I do think you're right, that if this is something that the people are supposed to carry with them, the genre is ideal for that. But being a more figurative genre, there's just the elasticity in the genre for her to make these kind of miraculous statements about the stars fighting from their courses that just doesn't have the same impact. I mean, when you read about similar kind of miraculous phenomena in Joshua, you know, with the sun standing still and things, it has a certain kind of effect, but there's something stirring about Judges 5 in a way that Joshua isn't. Mm-hmm. And so is it simply an emotive genre? No, but that emotive reception, I mean, that helps in the prophetic. I mean, prophets always use poetry. Yeah. It helps in this kind of rhetorical mode the prophets are working in to persuade. Poetry is persuasive. It gets you, one of my favorite literary scholars talks about how poetry invites you into seeing the world in a certain way, rather than telling you a story. It invites you into a worldview almost. And if this person's trying to help them reimagine what they have just seen from God's perspective, poetry provides the perfect medium through which to do that. Mm-hmm. Not just to get their hearts pumping, like it's an emotional worship set so that they can walk away, but because it can get in their bones, they can hear it in their head, it's going to get stuck there. And it allows her the flexibility she needs to give them some really powerful imagery that just would have been difficult to convey in another modality.
It's good.
Yeah, I think that's super helpful, because I think for some people we think, okay, poetry is the place where all the emotional, heart-driven people go to. I'm like a smart intellectual, so I can skip the poetry because I already read the historical narrative. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I think this is just a really important concept, because poetry is it's about a third of the Bible. And there's a lot of it.
It's the most theologically laden of all of it.
Yeah,
it's the most explicit statements about the deity, things that a narrator can gesture toward, things a narrator can kind of express through the outcome of actions. Here, a poet can just say it. This is what God is like, in a way that a narrator doesn't.
It's good.
It's theological education.
In fact, I wonder on this too, things you talk about is, so we obviously have a lot of poetry in the Bible, particularly the Old Testament, and you have some books almost entirely poetry. But what's interesting is when we have primarily a narrative book that then we just stop and we switch to poetry. And it almost seems to come out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And then we're back to primarily narrative. What's the role of poetry in these books, like, you know, Hannah's Prayer and Samuel, Deborah's poem here, or other places? How should we approach that?
Well, Hannah's song in Samuel is probably the best example, especially when we pair Hannah's song in 1 Samuel 2 with David's final words at the end of 2 Samuel. We have the same themes introduced, and they actually are the themes of the book of Samuel. To the extent that when I teach Samuel, I walk them through Hannah's song and I say, read Samuel this way. It's that clear. How she kind of highlights in there what's going to happen. And so there have been several studies that people have done, and I'm building on, to look at the roles of inset psalms or songs embedded in narrative. And this actually happens outside of the Bible rarely. Usually it's more of a pairing rather than something like set in the way they are here. But we do see this in other cultural contexts as well. But within the biblical corpus, it seems to be that the songs make explicit a theological truth that's implicit in the narrative. So almost always they're bringing thematic concerns to the fore, theological concerns to the fore, and providing clarity about the context. So they end up being kind of hermeneutical cues for us to kind of interpret the rest of the narrative a little bit better because of this theological clarity we've received. So if I had to kind of bottom line this for us, the way that poetry works in biblical narrative, I mean, in each context, it's doing something a little unique, but it tends to make explicit kind of theological statements and provide clarity that help us read the rest of the narratives. So in many ways, it's a hermeneutical cue. It's letting us know how to interpret things better. It says things clearer. It crystallizes themes. It brings them to the fore. And it provides us with what we need to read the rest of the narratives really well.
That's super good. Very helpful. So we have some listener questions, if you have some time to dig into some of these. We have one listener question. This might be a little bit simpler to answer. You've kind of talked about it already a little bit, but in case you have any other thoughts, Dylan asked, what's going on in the contrast between Judges 4 and 5? Is it more or less prominent Hebrew? And he has an interesting question here that maybe you can address too. Is Judges 5 exaggerating? And this might tap into kind of how we view poetry a bit. Yeah. So I can't read his mind, what he's exactly wanting to get at there. Totally. But do you have any response to this?
Yeah, well, and I think, you know, you're highlighting, not there are definitely some significant differences between the story and the song, especially if we're trying to piece back together exactly how things went on the ground. And I mean, I would argue that Deborah's like, that's not your job right now. Listen to what I'm trying to say. You know, she's like, stop trying to reconstruct the historical event and just listen to me. But that is a valid question. We still are trying to figure out what really happened. And there are significant differences. Like there are only a couple of tribes highlighted in the narrative, but in the poetic account, there's a lot more tribes enumerated. And also we have the theme of Sheol is cast slightly differently. It almost sounds, we have the mention of stars fighting from the sky. We have the mention of the mighty torrent Kishon, which is interesting because the Kishon is like a bubbling brook most of the year. And so we see it become a mighty torrent. So is that an exaggerative language? Really great question. I mean, poetry obviously is not attempting to describe things with scientific precision. That is not the goal of poetry. For poetry to be true does not require that. That's not its goal. But on the same, I mean, on the same hand, I would want to say in Judges 4, the emphasis is that Yahweh won the battle. In fact, the summary statement in 4:15 is that Yahweh routed Sisera and his troops. And that's sort of unique in Judges, that right in the midst of battle, it is attributed to Yahweh rather than to the judge or to the Israelite troops. And so it does seem that even Judges 4 says there was something miraculous that took place here. And so how then in poetry do we depict the miraculous intervention of the deity? Well, to talk about even the all of the forces of nature responding to him appropriately would involve him using cosmic entities, the stars, fighting from their courses. For all we know, that meant that it rained.
Yeah.
And that is a really poetic way of describing that. And because it rains, the Kishon flooded. And because the Kishon flooded, the chariots got stuck in the mud. And we can say that in a really boring way, or we can acknowledge that a deity was constructing this. And we can step back and say, the author of all creation decided to use creation, everything at his disposal, to ensure this victory. And the language Deborah uses emphasizes that quality.
Yeah.
And so I think that's part of the differences we're seeing. And because she's tying that event and kind of highlighting some of its more paradigmatic elements, she is focusing less on what happened with these specific tribes in this specific place and more about how this tells us that all the battles in the period functioned. So she is going to say, let's not just talk about these two troops or these two tribes. Let's talk about all of them. Because all of the northern tribes are in a place where they are struggling to hold their territory. So let's reflect on how all of them are responding to this battle and others like it. And so that's how I would explain those differences, not just genre, but what she's trying to do. She's tying it to this overarching story to help the people then respond more appropriately in the future.
Yeah, it's good.
That's super helpful. Yeah. If you have any comments or thoughts before we go to the next listener question.
No, I think that was very good, very succinct. And I think it's a great point. The Kishon became a mighty river, I guess you would say, in that moment, right?
Yeah.
So,
Which
again, elicits that Exodus it imagery does. Once again.
It does. It's absolutely. Exactly right. Yeah. And water. Which is what she's trying to do. Yep. And so she needed to use really different ways of describing a kind of mundane reality to help us see the spiritual work happening behind it.
in a way, you then have Judges 4 and 5 compounding on each other, which then makes it how much more ironic that Gideon specifically asks, where's the God who did these things for my ancestors in Egypt?
Yeah.
And it's like, I just did Egypt-like stuff. Like,
I just did that. I know. It is baffling. Well, and I also think in our preoccupation with comparing Judges 4 and 5, we always set them next to each other. Instead of realizing Judges 5 is stuck into.
Right. That's a good point.
There is actually a movement where this happened, this happened, this happened, and then a prophet revealed all this to them. So in the story of how God revealed himself to a people, this is not just parallel to Judges 4. This is something new.
Yeah.
She then explains the theological import of what happened. That is the next step in God's revelatory action in the period.
Yeah.
And so I think it's helpful for us to push ourselves to look at the two. Absolutely compare them, but then step beyond that as well.
Yeah. The hermeneutical element is interesting. It's as if in the present, the characters and of course the authors themselves are interpreting these events as in a theological way, right? It's a religious way of interpreting history. And it's really fascinating to see that there are moments when the characters themselves aren't doing that and they sort of get called out for it, right? Like wake up and see the Exodus-like things that are happening in your day. So
absolutely.
Okay. Next question is from Isabel. It's just a pretty specific one. Why don't we hear much about Lapidoth considering the culture, the husband of Deborah?
Yeah. Well,
you have any thoughts on that?
The one thing I'd say was kind of, I could point you back to something we talked about earlier in the interview, which is the fact that narrative is selective. The job of this narrative is not to help us understand Deborah and what her role was in her home or in society. It gives us enough so that we can identify her. We can identify her as a historical character. But it doesn't feel the need to kind of let us know about her home life. I mean, does she have kids? We don't know. There's a variety of questions we could keep them probing at, but the author, all we need to know is that this was Deborah. Her name was Deborah, wife of Lapidoth. That's just the way you would refer to her within her cultural context and her profession. That's all you needed to know. When we meet Huldah, we have something similar.
Right.
Huldah, when we find out who she is, we find out who her husband is, we know what his job is to explain why she lived so close by, but we only got the information we needed for the story. And so I think sometimes we assume that because of a cultural context, like her being a woman, would be so interesting. Like, why aren't we hearing more about the man to like explain what she's doing? And I would say within the story, she's a prophet. And so like, that's what we need to know. We're focused on the fact that she's a prophet. And once we check in that she's a prophet, that's where all of our focus is supposed to be. Like that's everything to this story. And so he falls to the wayside even because he's not important in that. And so whether he was around during any of this, we don't know. For all we know, he was one of the foot soldiers. For all we know, he accompanied her to battle. I mean, I often tell students when Barak went to Jael's tent, he probably wasn't alone. He probably had other people with him. It would be weird for him to be wandering around alone as the general of an army. And so the story's selective. It's telling us what we need to know. We need to know that Barak saw that so that when he sings with Deborah, it matters. We don't need to know about Lapidoth.
Yeah.
Okay. So Lori has a question. It's kind of a longer one. I'll just read it as she sent it in. There's kind of a lot going on here. I imagine in a way you can answer this for the book of Judges, but some of this might divert to, I don't know what better way to put this other than just like contemporary modern Christianity. So however you want to take this question. Lori says, I'm particularly interested in the Hebrew language insights related to the story of Deborah. As a physician leader, I'll be honest, I don't feel supported by conservative denominations in terms of the work I do. The current mantra is women should ideally be stay-at-home mothers. If they do work, it is because of necessity, and they should not take secular leadership roles. This view, in my opinion, is not a good strategy if we want to proclaim the gospel to others, including an ever-increasing number of women in leadership positions in our society. It would be helpful to delve into the story of Deborah and see how God used her and get a better sense of the role of women in the Old Testament.
Well, first of all, Lori, I hear you and I see you and I felt that, and I'm sorry you've had that experience. Beyond that, one of the things that's fascinated about Judges 4 and 5 is just how much we are surprised and kind of preoccupied with the fact that Deborah is a woman. That's just been really fascinating to me as I've read things. Again, we've so much of our exegesis has kind of glossed over her prophetic qualities because we are so surprised she's a woman. We really fixate on that in our exegesis. And so then we wonder about the gender dynamics, like should Barack be embarrassed that a woman's leading? And we wonder about all these other things. And I was like, Barack should be embarrassed that he said no to a prophet. Like, let's back this up. We missed the way that the story emphasizes who she is, all these Mosaic like qualities, all these other things. The fact that a woman was prophesying is actually, it is rare. I mean, I don't want to pretend that's not rare, but it's also not as big of a deal as sometimes we make it out to be. Women prophets were something we hear about in the Hebrew Bible. Mari had a bunch of women prophets. Right. Jack Sasson's commentary, he's always just like, of course she was a woman prophesying because he's a Mari expert and he knows that's just a thing. And so the fact that a woman is prophesying isn't actually as big of a deal as sometimes we make it out to be. Gender is definitely one of the themes the story uses to show us that God does something unexpected. But within the story, the unexpected is Jael, not Deborah. Yeah. Jael is who's unexpected. And what's unexpected about her is that the person who defeats the strong army general is a weak civilian woman. Mm. I would argue the connotation of woman in this context, it's not, gender roles are obviously there, and I don't want to underemphasize some of those things. But when we're talking about war in ancient Israel, and we're talking about a woman, what we mean is a non-combatant. Women, children, Levites, those are the people not fighting.
Yep.
So when we say a woman on a battlefield, we mean someone who's not fighting. And so for the terrifying general of Canaan who oppressed the people severely for a generation with all of these iron chariots that Judah and nobody else could defeat, when that guy is defeated by a civilian, it challenges the preoccupation with thinking that Israel's military weakness makes them an underdog. God says, by no means, it doesn't matter. And in Judges 5, when it says there were no shield nor spear in Israel, it's highlighting this element. You think that your armament defines your ability to win a battle. So I'm going to show you in this case with the person, the best armed in your recent cultural memory, I can defeat that person. And I'm not even going to use your general to do it. I'm going to use a non-combatant who is not an Israelite. Right. Just to convince you that there is no one who can't defeat someone in battle. And so we, I think, have taken the gender dynamics and kind of brought them into our cultural context, maybe in a way that misses the way it functioned in that context, which is to highlight, to kind of differentiate Jael from the battlefield. Deborah, again, is functioning in a role women functioned in. It still seems to be rare, at least in the way that the Hebrew Bible frames it, but not crazy. We see within the book of Judges, though, I will say this, there are more women in the book of Judges than pretty much anywhere. It's why so many female interpreters flock to Judges, because we're confounded by this. And it seems like what the author does in the book of Judges is kind of highlights the disintegration of society and the way that people treated each other by the way that vulnerable populations are treated. And so as we go through the book, we see women at the beginning, like we see Aksa seeming to have a positive role where like she is speaking. Othniel is considered like the best judge in the book. He never speaks, but his wife does. Aksa speaks, and she asks for more land, which is exciting because women were supposed to help men be faithful to Yahweh and do Yahweh things, which at that point is conquering the land. That's what Aksa does. She makes sure that he conquers land and conquers more land. By contrast, we see throughout the rest of the book that women are given, there are moments where women continue to help. There are other moments where women become victims. And as the book proceeds, that's what we see, increasing victimization of women to the point where at the end of the book, the epitome of a disintegrated society that is abandoning Yahweh is the victimization of hordes of women in 19-21. And so all of this to say, the book actually spends quite a bit of time saying that women shouldn't be treated the way they are treated in the book of Judges. And instead we see God using women because of who they were, what their gifts were, where they were, whatever they were doing, they were honored for that. We see her leading. Great. We see her going to battle. Nobody said, "I'm sorry, but the kids are at home. I can't go." For all we know, she had some of those hard conversations, but that wasn't important to the author, and it could have been. What was important was that God needed her. She did what she did, and she moved on.
Yeah.
So in some ways, it doesn't tell us enough about the gender dynamics for us to use that in a lot of the debates we try to use the story in. In my opinion, it just doesn't tell us enough for this to actually be a proof text for anybody, other than as a proof text that God uses women. It kind of wasn't a big deal. And in fact, if somebody had misconceptions about what women could do, they were surprised to find that God could use them to do anything. If it says anything about women, that's what it says.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Excellent.
That's super helpful. Super good. And I think there's actually a good practical thing though, like you said, that in the story, we're not surprised it's women. And, you know, this is more of a personal anecdotal comment. I think that's just a good approach that we should also have, right? Like, I think there's a point when we make such a big deal out of woman doing something, it's almost denigrating in a way, as opposed to highlighting, as opposed to like, you know, my wife is a physician, by the way, right? Like, I'm not surprised that she's in some epic career making more money than me and doing a great job at it, right? Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's just great. And, you know, let's just, as Christians, look, men, women together, like you said, let's just go do the work of God. And together, like you said, Othniel and his wife, we're both just trying to do God's will in the earth and using the strengths and gifts we have and doing the best we can to follow his will in our unique season of life. Sam, that's really good thoughts on Judges though, because like you said, there is a lot of attention. And interestingly, I like kind of not technically Judges, but Ruth and Hannah, they come into play right there at the tail end too. Yeah. So that's
totally,
I find that interesting where you have that. Yeah. Maybe you have any comments on this, but like you said, the deeper you get to Judges, the worse the treatment of women you get, almost viewed as like the epitome of this moral cesspool society.
Yeah.
But then in a way, what God uses to bring a new wave of hope is through these two women, Ruth and Hannah. And I just, that's kind of an interesting contrast there. I don't know what is going on, if we should make too much out of that or not, but that's just interesting to see.
Yeah. Well, and as you well know, I mean, in the canonical order of the Hebrew Bible, it's harder to make a big deal about it. But in the English Bible in particular, it is just like right before your eyes. But with it being set in the Judges period, that at least allows Ruth to shock us, because we are expecting Judges 19, and instead we get what we get in Ruth. And she, like Jael, is a non-Israelite woman who is being used by God as an instrument to, I mean, you know, she provides for Ruth. Sometimes we make Boaz the hero of that story, but somebody needs to read it again and recognize that Ruth was feeding her mother. Ruth. But that's neither here nor there.
Well, and in light of Judges 19, it's Bethlehem again, right? Bethlehem becomes central in Ruth. So it's fascinating.
There's some good work being done on reading the two together, and to what degree it seems to explicitly invite us to. I mean, the superscription in Ruth 1:1 really does seem to invite us to read the two texts intertextually.
Wow.
And so with so many of those, and especially with Hannah, Saul being from Gibeah, like there's so many connections with all three of those narratives. It's hard not to read all three of them in light of each other.
So people are listening to this and they're like, hey, Dr. Michelle Knight's awesome, I want more of her content, you know, I want some way to experience her. You know, obviously you teach at a university. I wonder if you can talk about, let's say someone wants to study with you, what program can they maybe sign up for, or if they want more of your content, where can they find you? And rumor has you got a lot of projects going on, so maybe you can give us some things to look forward to in the future.
Sure. Well, at TEDS, there are two programs where you could study with me. Our MDiv has some really cool classes where we are, on the one hand, doing like really integrative Hebrew grammatical exegetical work, but on the same time, we're talking through themes and theology, and we're working through these books, book by book, making sure we understand the argument the author's making. That kind of work happens in our MDiv at TEDS, and it is really good work, and it would prepare you to see how the Hebrew Bible is actually speaking to contemporary readers through the lives and thought patterns and everything of these ancient authors. But we also have a master's in Old Testament and Semitic languages where you can really like make sure you know your Hebrew in and out. You can look at these texts in a really detailed way. You can, you know, learn about the ancient Near East and some of those background things, but you can also take like Old Testament theology courses. So there's a lot of great stuff there. As for me specifically, I am writing, well, I'm in the process of my dissertation being published, so maybe in the next couple of years, if you are the person that reads monographs, you can watch for that, which is probably a small sliver of these listeners. But I am working on two commentaries, one on Joshua with Wittgenstock, the Bible and God's World series, and then one for Baker. It's their... I don't even know what Baker exegetical commentary in the Old Testament. It's whatever that is on Judges. And that'll be, it'll be a minute because it's kind of far out, but I also have a textbook coming on the historic. So the English historical books and that'll be out a little bit sooner. So, I mean, just give me a couple years and you'll have plenty to read.
Great. So those are some ways that people can connect with you, your content and stuff we can look forward to in the future. Do either of you two have any last comments we want to say, put on bow on this episode?
No, I thought it was an exceptional interview. Thank you, Dr. Knight, for being with us. Fantastic work, and I'm looking forward to your publications. It'll be coming out soon. So,
Thank you. It was a joy to talk about it, and I hope that everybody, when they read the story of JL, they don't cringe quite so much, and maybe you have new tools to recognize the good things God's doing in that story.
Yes. Awesome. Thank you so much for coming.
Yeah.